Hello, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 29th of April 2011 here in Japan. And today I'm joined from Buenos Aires, Argentina by Adrian Salbucci, an independent analyst and thinker and writer and someone who has come up with a very exciting way for tackling and defeating the New World Order. So Adrian Salbucci, it's great to have you here. Thank you for joining us once again.
My pleasure. How are you, Jim?
Well, I'm doing well, thank you, and I certainly hope things are going okay for you there in Argentina, but I'm sure many of my viewers and listeners are probably already familiar with you, either from our previous conversation or through your very popular videos, but for those people who aren't familiar yet, why don't you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, basically, I'm based here in Argentina. I've lived abroad, I've lived in the United States, I've lived in Britain, and in some time also in Germany. And I'm an independent consultant on risk management and financial matters. And having lived practically all of my adult life in Argentina, we've gone through a lot of systemic collapses, government takeovers, monetary collapses, hyperinflation. And many of the things that have happened to us throughout the decades seem to be small-scale tests or experiences of what later or now is starting to happen on a global basis. So what we've done is we pretty much scratched our heads and wondered why it all happened, how it all happened, who made it happen, and you start getting some conclusions from that. And from those conclusions, we are building a model that enables people, I think now the world over, before it was just Argentinians, now it's people the world over, it enables people to understand how that model works. And once you understand how a model works, Jim, it automatically becomes predictable. And predictability allows you to do strategic planning.
Very, very good points. Yes, absolutely. Well, today we're going to be talking about your idea for a second republic. But I guess before we get into the details of what that is and what that entails, we should first define why we need a second republic. What is it that we're trying to construct the second republic against?
Well, the basic idea, actually, let me just rewind for a second there. The last time Argentina had a major collapse was in 2001-2002. We had a full-fledged banking collapse, we had a full-fledged monetary collapse, and the economy was so badly impacted by this that gross domestic product fell 40% in 1 year, and half of our population fell below the poverty line. That meant the lower middle class, and most of them did not make it back. So that was very traumatic. And at that time, we were quite active trying to promote what we called the, well, it would translate from Spanish as the Argentine Second Republic Movement. And the rationale behind it was that for various reasons, which would be too lengthy to explain and very specific to Argentina, we realized that our nation state, our public institutions, had for one reason or another been hijacked by seen and unseen forces. Let's simplify it by saying the banking cabal, the international bankers and so forth, through Argentina's foreign public sovereign debt. So we said, okay, so the problem, we defined it the following way. The problem with Argentina nowadays, which, by the way, is an immensely, almost incalculably wealthy country, the problem with Argentina is that our nation state, instead of providing for the common good of the people and defending the national interest, has slowly transformed into a colonial administration entity. In other words, our public government, our nation state, became an administration entity for the global power elite. So we said, okay, what we need to do is drop the first, the present Argentine Republic, and found or refound a second republic. And we used as an example France. France, since the French Revolution, has gone through several republics, and they're now actually in the Fifth Republic. Right after the Second World War, well, the Fourth Republic was horrendous because it was founded after the Second World War, after the German invasion from 1940 to 1944. It was all very traumatic, and the country became chaotic. And it was in 1957 that a true statesman, Charles de Gaulle, proposed founding a Fifth French Republic, In other words, dealing the cards once again, so that would finally get France on its feet. And now they've had a lot of problems, but we must admit that since 1958, when the Fifth French Republic was founded with a new constitution, France has not done badly, and they have been the ideological powerhouse of what later was to become the European Union. So it hasn't gone bad for them.
Well, yes, very interesting. So you're talking specifically, and you're writing and thinking in the Argentinian context, but this is an idea that transcends those national boundaries.
Yeah, well, let me tell you why it actually started transcending it. We've done quite a lot down here. We haven't been able to, obviously, set up a strong political entity because you need tons of money for that. And we figure whoever puts the money in will want to call the shots. So we're trying to do this rather heroically on a personal initiative basis with all the people, all the more humble working people down here that are part of the Argentine Second Republic movement. But what happened was that at the beginning of last year, in March of 2010, I was invited by a very close friend of mine, who happens to be Canadian also, as yourself, Philip Jarman, who has a private financial consultancy. He invited me to a commercial meeting in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And at that meeting, there were basically two speakers, G. Edward Griffin, whom I admire enormously, who's the expert probably on the Federal Reserve Bank, and myself. And to make a long story short, we discussed everything. And during my presentation, I said, well, in Argentina, we had all these problems. And we reached the conclusion that since our country had been transformed into a colonial administrative entity, we had to found a second republic. And the idea caught on. And what we did is we decided, a small group of us, and we're working very hard at this, to create Second Republic, the concept, which we applied to Argentina until that time, to apply it as a sort of template, because there are five basic pillars around which Second Republic rallies, and they are basically the same for just about any country. The details will naturally change, because each country has its own problems, its own characteristics, but the basic idea would still hold. So we found it, and we have actually a website on this, which is Second Republic Project, altogether, secondrepublicproject.com, which we are building, and we've already placed in that site five videos describing the five basic pillars, and we're starting to put a series of white papers into that site so that people from the world over will be able to, A, become members or founding members, so to speak, and also start learning about at least what our proposal is all about and seeing how they can apply it to their specific countries based on their specific problems and their specific history.
All right, then, well, let's start getting into some of the details of what you're talking about here. You've mentioned there are five pillars to the Second Republic idea. Tell us about those pillars.
Yeah, before I do that, let me just very basically say why we arrived at those five pillars. First of all, what we did here in Argentina, Jim, was use absolute common sense. So we figured, okay, let's start by understanding how the world really works, which is not the way the BBC and CNN and Fox News and the New York Times and the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal tells us that as it works. Let's really understand how the world works, how power has been privatized, how governments, even Mr. Obama and even Mr. Cameron in Britain, no longer call the shots, that there are entities above the public nation state in every country who are really calling the shots. And we call it the privatization of power. So let's start by understanding how the world really works. When you understand the way the world really works, that leads you to a second point. You start understanding why your country is in such a dire state, whether it be in America, Argentina, Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, where we have a lot of very good friends, Japan, I suppose, as well, although I'm not very knowledgeable about the Japanese scene specifically. So you start understanding why we are in such dire states, straits. And when you do that, you start understanding why the global power elite want you and me and all your viewers to think and behave in a certain set of ways. And at the same time, they don't want us to think and behave in certain other alternative ways. So we scratched our heads and said, well, come on, if we understand what they don't want us to do, or what they want us to do, rather, let's do exactly the opposite. So, for example, and here come the five pillars. They don't want any country to have a sovereign nation state, which is the sole republican institution that will promote the common interest and promote the common good and defend the national interest. So let's found a second republic. Let's found a new sovereign nation state. That's the basic idea behind a second republic. Second pillar. The most important thing that a sovereign nation state has to do is recover its national currency, not the way it's been hijacked in America by the Federal Reserve or in Europe through the European Central Bank or in Argentina through a privately controlled, even though formerly public, central bank. Third, reject the debt-based economic system, which in the case of Argentina would mean investigating our sovereign public debt, which is totally fraudulent from the very beginning. Probably in other countries it would be different. Probably in America it would mean auditing the Fed, and maybe in Europe it would mean something different. But all countries have that debt-based economic system that we must reject. The fourth pillar is let's recover our republican institutions. The way so-called democracy works is that they use the entire political structure and they make it subordinated to and dependent on money. Now, money is not democratic. So if we have a so-called democratic system dependent on money, that's no democracy at all. Or even worse still, it's the best democracy that money can buy. And the fifth and last pillar is they have totally turned our values upside down. Let's put them right side up again. When this is a very short and compressed description, but we are when you start looking at those five pillars, they will give you a basic model through which you can put just about any problem that any country will have, and one way or another, the common sense solution will shine through of its own. You don't need rocket science for this. It's just basic common sense applied to people thinking with our own minds and not with the global power elite's minds through all the rubbish they sell us in as I say, in their mainstream media.
Well, I realize that is kind of the whirlwind overview of the five pillars, so let's get a little bit more into the details. Just listening to that overview, it does strike me, and I'm sure many of the viewers, that finance and the national monetary system is a key part of this. Tell us more about your what you envision would be a type of currency and debt or non-debt-based money that would actually work to empower the people rather than enslave them.
Yeah, that's probably the crucial point because it's like the old saying from Lord Rothschild from the 19th century: "Give me the power to handle a country's money, and I don't care who governs, who makes its laws, etc." That's been repeated hundreds of times, but really, controlling the currency of a country and the monetary supply and the monetary system gives you almost complete power. And what we say is, let's start by making a strict distinction between public money and private money. Public money is the dollars or the pesos or the yen that we all have in our wallets. And that has a particularity that very often people forget. Public money belongs to the people. It's like the national territory. If you are a Japanese or a Canadian citizen, you can say, well, all of Canada belongs to the Canadians, which doesn't mean that all Canadians have the same allotted space. A lot of people have a lot of land in Canada, and maybe others don't even have their own home. But that's not the point. The point is that Canada belongs to the Canadians, irrespective of how you might split up the Canadian territory. The same thing with public money. Public currency, public money, belongs to we the people. It does not belong to the banks. It does not belong to anybody to fiddle around with it. Independent of the fact that a lot of people are millionaires and maybe other people have little money in their own wallets. But the key point is that public money, since it belongs to the people, it is a public utility, so to speak, and it does not, should not generate interest. If you have 100 peso bill or 100 yen bill in your wallet and you leave it there for a year, there's no reason why you should expect it to reproduce itself, and in a year's time you should have 110 yen or 120 yen. It will still be the same monetary value. Private money, however, which is the banking money created by the banking system, which as a whole, perhaps not any bank individually, but as a whole, through fractional lending, creates money out of nothing. Not only do they create private money out of nothing, which are just blips on your computer screen or perhaps a printout on your banking statement or in other more sophisticated financial instruments and financial media, but on top of it, they create the money out of nothing and they charge you interest for it. So definitely the problem is, and this is the way we see it, and I think it helps to explain the global financial collapse of 2008, is that the banking cartel need to take over the public monetary entity and the public monetary system, ensuring that there is never enough public, non-interest-bearing money for all the needs of the real economy. And since there is not enough public money, in they come and say, don't worry about it. You need money, I'll loan you the money. And they loan you the money by creating it scripturally out of nothing. And on top of it, they will charge you interest. So they, what they do in the long run is they generate an entire economic system which is based on debt. We're all indebted. The nation states are indebted. Look at America, $14 trillion or $14.5 trillion national debt. Corporations are indebted, individuals are indebted, credit cards, mortgages, car loans, etc. And the key question is, the entire planet is indebted, but indebted with whom? And that is the key question that I think is very much avoided by the powers that be. So if we start with that, differentiating between public money and private money, and ensuring that the public money supply is based on the common interest and not on the banker's interest, that's when you realize that America has a big problem because the Federal Reserve Bank is privately controlled. And Argentina has a problem because although Argentina, which is probably the more common model, although our central bank is formally a government organism, because there's a sort of dogma that says that central banking has to be independent, so it is independent of government policy. And you realize how through a rather labyrinthical method, the private bankers end up controlling the central bank through a more complex system. And the key question that I ask down here is, if Argentina's central bank is independent of government, but as a taxpayer, I pay for their salaries, well, then I want to know who the central bank responds to. And that's when you realize that whether it be in Argentina, in Brazil, in Europe, even in America in a different way, certainly in Canada, they end up responding to the private bankers who wield huge power to control the central bank and control the ideas that public opinion has regarding what a central bank should be and should not be.
Well, you raise the very important question, indebted to whom? And I think it's a question that a lot of people are thinking more and more about as we hear, of course, in the United States right now, the debate raging over the national debt. How do you answer that question and how would you like to change that that system?
Well, first of all, I think that the basic policy, the basic what is the basic need of any economy? To have the necessary funding in order for things to be done. For example, here in Argentina, we have a country that is potentially hugely wealthy. We are five times the size territorially of France. Argentina, just to give you an idea, to give your viewers an idea, is so large that we are as long from north to south as America is from east to west. We have a small population, only 44 million people. The more richer parts of our territory are practically uninhabited. They have very, very, very small population. So we need to build roads, we need to build ports, we need to build airports, we need to build just about everything. However, the government or the state, which should do the strategic planning to integrate the country, a country like Argentina needs roads, needs railways, needs just all the basic infrastructure. And yet even the nation state will say, I cannot do that by issuing the necessary money because that's inflationary. It's part of the false dogmas that we've been imposed. So even the nation state, even the Argentine government will go and seek money from the private bankers. The IMF will almost impose it upon them. So what do they do? The money comes in, it comes in dollars, it comes in with huge interest payments, and we have Argentina, which is practically collapsed under the weight of a basically fraudulent public debt. And you figure, well, what would be the alternative? A state can issue the necessary currency to create all infrastructure, for example, that will enlarge or make the economy grow. So if you build a highway from, say, Buenos Aires to one of our larger cities in the interior of the country, And as that highway is built, you finance it. Instead of with private money banker credits, you finance it with actual monetary issuance, with public money. As the money goes and pays for the cement, the steel, the workers, the consultants, the architects, and so forth, part of that money automatically flows back to the government through taxes, through increased economic activity, because as you build the road, you will have gas stations and restaurants and even new towns springing up. So the government's obligation with public money is to provide the amount of money that the real economy needs to grow, but to grow in the public interest. As that money has been issued, the government can recover it through taxes and, if need be, burn it. Or if the road did not enable them to recover the full amount of money, they can charge a toll road, and then as the money comes in, they can also burn it. That's in an extreme case. What an intelligent government would do is, as it finances with public funding, and with sovereign currency intelligently used, as it finances these infrastructure projects and the economy grows, it can recycle those very same monetary issuances to build other projects, whether it be a port, an airport, and so forth. You would figure, okay, that's inflationary. And I would say no. What's inflationary, and we know a lot about it in Argentina, because in 1989, our previous crisis, we had hyperinflation. We had 10,000% inflation in 1 year. And it was created because the government issued all the money it needed just to pay for government workers, for police, for teachers, and so forth. And government workers and the police and teachers, although we need them, they do not enlarge the economy. Teachers merely create future minds for future kids who will be someday economically useful. But at the moment, a teacher's salary does not grow the economy. So that part of government spending has to be covered by taxation. That's what taxes are all about. But if the state says, no, I'm building a road where there was nothing, now there's going to be a road, and there's going to be new towns, there's going to be a whole lot of economic activity, that monetary issuance merely satisfies the greater need of a growing economy. And that's the secret that's been hidden. And I think that you probably have seen it, and many have seen it, The Secret of Oz by Bill Still. It's a video. The point that he makes is that the secret lies in the quantity of money. So the state's public obligation is to control the quantity of money. There have been experiments, Jim, throughout history, which were very clumsy because it involved stamping bills and doing a lot of things which was just almost above the municipal level in Europe. It was almost impossible to do in the 1920s and in the 1930s. But nowadays, with computer technology, the state can fully control the exact amount of money that the economy needs and issue it or withdraw it from circulation.
That's exactly right. Okay, well, so let's move on. I mean, the finance is such a key issue here, but there are other parts to this project, and it goes a lot beyond just the monetary concern of the people. So I mean, once we get that, if we're able to institute a new monetary system, that's still not the end of the struggle, because the forces arrayed against us are acting in so many different ways. What are some of the other ways in which this Second Republic project will hopefully overturn the New World Order?
Yeah, well, that brings, I'm going to jump very quickly to what we described as the fifth pillar, and I'll tell you why. Because the fifth pillar means restoring our values. And what I mean by that, I don't want to be, rather goody-goody about it, but rather be very pragmatic and very commonsensical. Nowadays, we have the world has all its priorities turned upside down. For example, finance will completely control the economic system. The economy will control the political system, whereby you have politicians, that it happens in America, it happens in Argentina, who are paid by major corporations and so forth. And this political system destroys our cultural values, and that in turn has created probably the moral fall of most of the world. However, what we propose is putting things the other way around. The financial system should be totally subordinated to the real economy, because what really counts is people who get up every morning, go to work, and build cars, bake bread, render services, drive cabs, build bridges, build buildings, and so forth. That is the real economy. And finance needs to be subservient to that real economy. Look at it. If you look at the present statistics, the gross domestic product of the entire planet is of around $70 trillion, with America and Europe being the top two economies so far. So you have a $70 trillion gross domestic product, a real economy on a planetary basis, of $70 trillion. And yet, we know that the hedge funds alone, just to take one small part of finance, is something like 20 times bigger. So you figure, how can the financial system grow 20, 30, 50 times more than the real economy? What we have nowadays is a financial system that has grown through speculation so vastly that it is acting like a cancerous tumor, and it is metastasizing, and today it threatens to kill the economic body of the entire planet. Because, Jim, if you look at it, the economies of the whole world are pretty much intact. You have problems, obviously. Well, in Japan now, you have the problem because of the 11th of March earthquake. But the economies are pretty much intact and working, certainly down here in Argentina and throughout Latin America. What is it that has collapsed? It's the financial system. And because it's been given too much power to impose who's going to be the president of the United States, what the media are going to say, what will be taught in universities regarding what money is and what it is not, they just have too much power, and that is probably the key problem of the whole world. So what we need to do is put finance back in its place and make it subservient to the economy. Now, that alone in itself is probably a war. And I don't mean a war in military terms. I mean a war in psychological warfare, economic warfare, in people really making a great effort for that. The economy should be subordinated to a political project. What is the political project? What is the political model that Canada or America or Japan or Argentina needs? The economy has been to be subservient to that. And even our laws reflect that. Because if I make a lot of money with a sugar factory, the political system will be okay, fine, it's very good. But if I were to say, hey, wait a minute, if instead of manufacturing sugar, I manufacture cocaine, I will land in jail. Why? Because the economic activity of having a sugar factory is good for the common good. The economic activity of selling cocaine is terrible for the economic, for the political system. So we have to be landed in jail. So the economy has to be subservient to the common interest, which is the function of politics. And politics, I believe, has to be subservient to a country's culture. Let me give you an example. The nation state of India has to make it illegal to kill a cow because the Hindu religion says that cows are sacred. The nation state of Argentina says it's just fine to kill a cow because we like to have barbecues. We have very good meat. Who's right? Who's wrong? They're both right. The Indian nation state is respecting Indian culture. Argentina's nation state is respecting Argentinian culture and values. And they're both correct. We have to learn to do those differentiations. And as a final comment, I personally believe that each country's culture has to be subordinated to, or at least have that intuition that there is a superior order, probably an invisible one, call it whatever you want, Buddha, God, Christ, you give it the name you want, which gives significance to all human actions, whether they be private or public or collective group as a nation. So when you get all these, when you put all these values that have been turned upside down, you put them right side up, half of any country's problems will become resolved, will solve themselves. That is why I believe, to wrap it up, that the media and especially schooling makes such a great effort to confuse us, to give us the wrong information, to give us slices of info, but they put the dots on the table, but then they connect them incorrectly, so we just end up getting an incorrect figure. It's not a question. Nowadays, people are very informed, but they're not knowledgeable. We have to worry a little bit less about having all the details, which will often clutter us and even swamp us, and try to understand the basic models, both the model of the enemy and what he is imposing upon us, and what would be a good alternative model, which, as I say, in our case, we believe is founding a second republic in just about every country in the world. And then, obviously, peoples will understand that we have common problems, common interests, common desires, and we should naturally have all countries coming together to work shoulder to shoulder for the common good of humanity.
Well, you raise the prospect of war, whether that be psychological war or economic war or all the other forms of warfare directed against the people who are saying the types of things that you're saying, because we've seen, obviously, over the last decade at least, the global war on terror being constructed as this mythical overarching narrative to try to put revolutionary ideas like this into a certain context whereby we can demonize anyone who dares to threaten the status quo. And so there's no doubt that as this movement begins to gain steam and as changes are really in the pipeline and starting to come about, there will be incredible backlash against this. What forms do you see that backlash taking, and how do we counteract that?
Well, let's take one that's in the headlines nowadays. We have the so-called rebels in Libya who are helped by the CIA in the daytime fighting against the Gaddafi forces with bombs, with machine guns, etc. And then at nighttime, they're designing a new central bank. I think that tells us something. And even some commentators from NBC were saying, wow, this is surprising that a revolution, so-called revolutionaries who are in the midst of a civil war should sit back in the evening and start designing a new central bank, because the powers that be know that whatever comes out of Libya, they will need to control the Libyan currency. Because today, with Muammar Gaddafi, and I'm not defending him, but what he's done, he's definitely on the right track. The Central Bank of Libya is fully government controlled, and he has been able, or Libya has been able, to give interest-free credits that have redistributed wealth quite nicely in Libya. Libya has the highest GDP per capita in Africa. Libya has the highest literacy rate in Africa. There are interest-free loans, and you have them building this massive, I think it's the largest man-made river or seaway, bringing water from the Nubian aquifer to start developing the rest of Libya. In other words, he's really thinking very politically and very strategically, and that probably is one of the reasons why he's being attacked. And they are immorally saying, Mr. Cameron, Mr. Bush, and Mr. Sarkozy, that Gaddafi has to be assassinated. He is a danger because he has, amongst other things, I think he has implemented pillar number two of a second republic very well. So, no doubt, the worst-case scenario is that they're going to come in and bomb you out of existence the way they are doing with Libya. However, speaking from a much more peaceful side of the world, which is Argentina, thank God in the case of Latin America, we are not being invaded. In the case of all of Latin America, and certainly in the case of Argentina, the method of control that they have chosen, instead of bringing in the troops like Iraq, like Afghanistan, like Libya, and the way they love to do with Syria and Iran, they have controlled us economically. They have controlled us through finance by imposing upon Argentina, for example, as I was saying before, a totally fraudulent debt, which we, and they have governments that will successively always pay it. So one of the things I tell my people down here is, if Argentina had to fight this war militarily, forget it. There's nothing we could do. If Argentina had to fight this war financially and economically, within their system, there is nothing we can do. However, the war that Argentina has to fight is basically a psychological war. And a psychological warfare, we are just as potentially strong as any other country. And so is Brazil, and so is Japan, and so is Canada. So if people the world over open their eyes and they start to understand where the trap lies, why they want us to consider that money is what they define it is and not define it in another way, why we should be really recovering the control over our sovereign currency through a central bank that is geared on the common good and the national interest, well, definitely that those eye-openers, that awakening of the people will probably mean that we will start being able to undo what the global power elite are doing. And this is a good time to do it, Jim, because they themselves are in the midst of a massive crisis, which is of their own doing, but which also has a lot to do with another process that I think has to be very much kept in mind, and that is that they are wrapping up globalization and moving on to formal world government. So that in itself is a huge war that they are waging against humanity. So whether we like it or not, we have to face that reality, and we can only do that from our respective countries. Just as globalization was imposed upon us from top to bottom, recovering and being able to fight back will have to be done from bottom to top. And bottom to top means from grassroots, from municipalities, which turn into provinces, which turn into nations. And as nations can come together, at least we can do something to mitigate the damage that they are doing and identify their huge weaknesses, because strategic planning always tells us when you identify a weakness in your adversary, it automatically becomes a strength for you.
Very well put. I agree very much with that assessment, because it's quite clear that this economic crisis that we see going on right now has been brought about on purpose in order to liquefy international relations, in order for the New World Order to cement its world government, its nascent world government. And I think that liquefaction could also work in our favor, because the destabilization means there are more people who are willing to listen to alternative ideas like the Second Public Republic project. So tell us, where do you think we are in the timeline of being able to institute some of these ideas?
I think we're probably in it's smack in the midst of one of the most critical points within this whole process. And for this, Jim, we need to do something that they have been very good at and that we have to understand. I'm 58 years old. I'm probably by now the fourth, maybe the fifth generation of people who have been educated, elementary school, high school, and college, to be short-term thinkers. We have all been educated to think in the short term, get a career, get married, get a life. In other words, plan your own life and forget about any long-term thinking. However, the global power elite, and that's what Harvard and Princeton and Yale and Oxford and Cambridge are there for, the global power elite have been educated in long-term thinking. And long-term thinking is a very complex beast. It means starting something today, the results of which may come 10 years down the road, or maybe 20, or starting something today, the results of which you won't see, your children or your grandchildren will see. And that's what the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Bushes are very good at. So they know that they can do their long-term planning smack in front of our noses, and we don't even realize it because we have not been trained to identify long-term processes because we can only think in the short term. On top of it, short-term thinking makes you very geared on yourself, which makes you egotistical, which breaks down basic social solidarity of working together against a common purpose. So the short-term thinking, we have to start thinking in long-term the way they do. And when you look at it in long-term, this is my conclusion. Just as 21, 22 years ago, they realized that the bipolar world had served its purpose and that they had to move on. And that's what the Trilateral Commission was founded in 1973 for. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's former national security advisor, spells it out quite clearly in his 1971 seminal book, Between Two Ages, The Role of America in the Technotronic Age. They realized that they had to now move on to globalization, but they had to get rid of the Soviet Union. And instead of going into an outright military conflict, which would have been mutually assured destruction, they infiltrated the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, with capitalist companies and capitalist culture, and the former Soviet Union collapsed without firing a shot. They did that very well. It took them 20 years, but they achieved it. And that's what the Berlin Wall falling, the reunification of Germany, the demise of the former Soviet Union meant in 1990, 1989, 1990, 1991. But globalization also is just a step on the way to something even bigger. Globalization was the 20-year period that they needed, amongst other things, to install the electronic and technological infrastructure for total societal control, for the full control of people, the internet, cellular telephones, communications, 500-channel TV, radio frequency ID chips, GPS, etc., all the stuff we know. So now they have in place the technology, which they control, for total control of people, even though the internet is a two-edged sword. They still know that they control it. Now they have to close globalization, they're wrapping it up, and move on to the New World Order, which is world government. Every time they say New World Order, they're merely describing the next stage that they want to found. Because don't forget, when the Council on Foreign Relations was founded in 1919, they spoke about a New World Order after World War I. Then in 1944, 1945, they spoke about the New World Order with Bretton Woods and the United Nations after the Second World War. Then they spoke of a New World Order. Bush Sr. said it openly in 1991 when they were wrapping up the bipolar world and ushering in globalization. And now the New World Order is they are wrapping up globalization and moving on to formal world government, which, contrary to globalization, which has been very horizontal, borderless, chaotic, quite even dangerous in a way for them, now world government will be very vertical, very authoritarian, very police-like, and that is what they are moving us onto. They are dragging us to that. And whilst the bipolar world into globalization was relatively peaceful, globalization unto world government is becoming a highly violent and dangerous process for every country in the world.
That's exactly right, and you bring out so many good points there, but I think it's absolutely incumbent upon all of us to really understand and to try to cope with the idea that the system that we've been placed into has not just come about overnight. I mean, it's something that's been carefully crafted over generations. And you talk about Brzezinski back in the 70s and talking about the new era of globalization and pointing out that the Soviet Union had to go. Well, it's important to understand that the Soviet Union itself was brought about and prompted into existence and funded and supplied by the American Wall Street interests that gained from having that bipolar world. When that bipolar world was out of fashion, they needed to usher in the globalization era. Now that globalization is out of fashion, they want the one world government era. And you're right, this is a long-term strategic plan that's been unfolding for generation after generation. And it's difficult for a lot of us to understand that such a thing can even happen, let alone how it comes about. And then to think about having to counteract that, obviously it's going to be a generational struggle again. So on that note of the New World Order type political elite always funding the opposition, do you see a way for the Second Republic project might be co-opted, or that idea might be attempted to be subverted by the interests who are actually working for world government as a way of discrediting the movement or trying to lead it off into unproductive solutions?
Oh, absolutely. Since this is a war, albeit basically a psychological war, war always entails risk. And there is definitely the risk that they will try to co-opt Second Republic or any similar movement in just about any part of the world, if not destroy it. Vladimir Lenin, since you spoke about the former Soviet Union, Lenin used to say that a true revolutionary, the way they are, has to control actions and reactions. And since they know that for every action there will be a reaction for people like yourself and myself, they will try to co-opt it and shove it into a dead-end street. So, you know, that is something that we have to be very careful and very alert to. This is like being on the Titanic. You have to look out for those icebergs all the time. You can't take a rest for a 15 or a 20-minute rest. If you take a rest, well, look what happens. Look at the Titanic. So that being said, the one of the key points, and this is very important for our American listeners, is that just as the move from the bipolar world to globalization required for one of the superpowers to go into the waste bin of history, and that superpower was the former Soviet Union. And the fact that it went so quietly, I think, is proof that above the Kremlin and above the White House, there is a much higher power that be. Now, as we move from globalization to world government, the other superpower that has to go is the United States of America. Not that it will disappear like that. It will be like the former Soviet Union, turned into something much smaller, like the Soviet Union is now 20 independent states, smaller entities. America will also see its relative power wane dramatically. There might even be a territorial split, we don't know, because a global government cannot tolerate that there should be any superpower, because now the White House and Congress is in the hands of friends, the Bushes, the Clintons, the Obamas. But what would happen if tomorrow a true patriot, an American patriot, were to come into the Oval Office and were to say, okay, I don't like what we're doing militarily abroad. I don't like the people we're attacking. I'm going to start supporting some of them. I don't like the Federal Reserve the way it's run. I'm going to just stop it and start up a new central bank. I don't like what the bankers are doing. I'm going to put them in jail. And all these measures, which would be geared on the national interest of the people of the United States and not on the interest of the bankers. I don't like America's unflinching and unconditional alignment and subservience to the interests of international Zionism in general and the state of Israel in particular. I'm going to change all of that. Well, if somebody were to do that in the Oval Office at the White House, that would be, it could even spell death for world government. So they need for the United States to also become something much smaller, much more controllable, an upgraded version of what today Argentina and Brazil and the countries in Latin America are.
All right, well, we could really spend hours and hours fleshing this out, but I guess the point is that I want to leave with the viewers and listeners is that there are things that we can be doing to start changing the system. So let's get into some specific things that people can be doing and how you want to see this playing out in the short term.
Well, yeah. First of all, allow me to quickly say that there we have a website, which is www.secondrepublic.com, where we've uploaded videos and white papers and so forth, and I think people can see a lot of that and have an idea. In general terms, and applying again, as I say, basic common sense, I think that there are 10 things that we can do. The first is we have to open our eyes and ears, and that's what programs such as the Corbett Report are doing so wonderfully, and a lot of alternative media on the internet is doing. Secondly, we have to stay alert, like the guy and the Titanic. We have to stay alert for all these icebergs that are all over the place. We have to see the world around us, third, the way it really is. Fourth, we have to use common sense. Use your own mind. Don't think with the mind of the Wall Street Journal or Fox News or CNN, because they are part of the system. Fifth, we have to stay calm. Like when the Titanic started sinking, people went into panic. That meant certain death. Stay calm. We have to be ice cold in our thinking. Sixth, we have to act diligently. Do whatever has to be done in wherever we are, and do it diligently and do it correctly. Seventh, we have to be optimistic. Don't see it as something, oh no, the world, the global power elite are too big. There's nothing we can do about it. Don't forget that one of the premises of psychological warfare is to make the enemy think, we're the enemy for them, to make the enemy think that they are much stronger than they really are, and to make us feel that we are much weaker than we really are. And I'll accept that there is a big gap, but it's not that big. So when we realize that the gap is not all that big, that gives us the necessary optimism to really start doing what has to be done at the right time. Eighth, alert family, friends, colleagues, neighbors. The more people that know what's really happening, the more critical mass we can build to turn things around. And that critical mass means merely people of a certain quality, not quantities. All great things in history have been done by relatively small groups of people. And ninth and tenth, basically defend your spiritual values, which is what the fifth pillar of the Second Republic is all about, and defend your material values. Defend your house, defend your stuff, be very save for a rainy day, don't put all your money in the banks, and obviously, you know, try to have things planned so that if an emergency comes about of whatever nature, that you are more or less ready. At least being ready from here, being ready in your mind and in your heart will give you a head start.
That's right. Well, absolutely. Trying to get ourselves off of the system that's enslaving us is obviously one of the first and key steps. So I agree. Well, so secondrepublic.com is the actual website for the Second Republic Project. How about your own personal website?
So it's Second Republic Project altogether, secondrepublicproject.com. And my own personal website is www.asalbucci, that's asalbucci.com.ar. And on YouTube, I've got a whole lot of videos which have been uploaded as A.R. Salbucci. Oh, and by the way, tomorrow at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time on American Freedom Radio, which is an internet network, I'm starting my own radio program, 2 hours every Friday at 9 p.m. Central Standard Time, which is called Second Republic, quite fittingly. You visit American Freedom Radio, altogether AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and you can listen to it automatically. We go live at 9 p.m. Central Standard every Friday, and then they will be posting it on the website, so you can listen to it whenever you want afterwards.
Excellent. Well, I have read your book in English, and it is full of extremely interesting information, so I do suggest that people go out there and get it. Adrian Salbucci, just an incredible overview of an incredibly complex and detailed subject, so I hope people will start researching it for themselves at secondrepublicproject.com, and I hope we can talk about this more in the future as the Second Republic develops and as your radio program starts to get the word out to even more people. So once again, Adrian Salbucci, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure, and I'm always at your fullest disposal. Thanks a lot, Jim.